For Pacifica Radio, April 26th, 2020. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com and author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. You can find my full interview archive, more than 5,000 of them now going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, introducing Mitchell Plitnik. He is the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy, and he's got a new piece at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and it's called Israel's Unity Government Protects Netanyahu from Prosecution, Paves the Way for Annexation. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today here. So, first of all, can you take us back here? This is the third election or the fourth election that they've had in a row there, trying to figure out who can form a majority in the Israeli Knesset, and they finally got it done by having the two major opponents compromise and join in a coalition government together. Is that it?
Right. This is the third election in just over a year. And, you know, in the end, what they came to was something they could have come to after the first election if they, you know, had so chosen. It came about because some right-wing parties, particularly the Israel is Our Home, Yisrael Beitenu party of Avigdor Lieberman, decided they would not join a coalition with Netanyahu. So that sort of tipped a balance. The problem from the other side was that in order for the opposition led by Benny Gantz to form a government, they would have had to have the support of the joint list, which is mostly it's a coalition of parties that are mostly parties of Palestinian citizens of Israel. And that was difficult because some of the people involved, including Gantz himself, were not very comfortable with getting support from Arab parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, I mean, was it the case that if he had gone ahead with the joint list that other parts of his coalition would have dropped out, or he actually could have been the prime minister if only he had made a deal with them?
Well, it would have been difficult. It's hard to say that other parts of the coalition would have necessarily dropped out. What we saw was that two members of his own party, Gantz's own blue and white party, bolted at the idea of even just getting support from the joint list. Now, this was about the joint list supporting Gantz from outside of the government. So it would have been a minority government, but would have had the support of the joint list to defend itself against no confidence votes, had it actually managed to get a government that would have then been approved by the president and the Knesset.
So, in other words, you're saying
definitely a difficult road.
They would have had a majority in the Knesset to have the government, but they would have not gotten any minister posts within it, is what you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, they would not have officially been part of the government, but they just would have gotten something from that government, one would think, in exchange for assurances that they would protect it against no confidence votes. But even at that, they would have only been, even with that, the joint list included, they would have only had about 62 out of the 120 seats in an optimal situation. So it was a government that could easily have been brought down and would have over almost any dispute, because it would have depended on parts of even the blue and white coalition, such as the Telem party, is a right wing party led by Moshe Ya'alon. They were not at all comfortable with the joint list, but they were willing to go along with it to get Netanyahu out. Same with Lieberman's party. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't have taken long for something to happen to shatter that coalition. So it wasn't a very realistic option, but it was certainly something that Gantz could have pursued if he wanted to stick to his campaign promise of not joining a government led by Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm. And now it's interesting, right, that this is not the law in Israel, but this is the tradition that so far any would-be prime minister would prefer to lose and let the other guy be prime minister rather than join in a coalition with these Arab parties.
I mean, essentially, I mean, I don't think that's the way any of them would characterize it, of course. And I don't think, and in fairness, I don't think that is the way they think about it. But in practice, certainly that's the way it works out. They, the mainstream parties, do not want to be in a coalition with the Arab parties. Now, they will say that it's because those Arab parties are not Zionist, which is true, and there's a certain validity to that, since virtually all of the Jewish parties are Zionist, except for the religious parties, which have religious objections to Zionism, but not political ones. So on the political questions of the Jewish state, they usually go along with the Zionist parties, not just cynically, but you know, honestly. But the reality is that people are uncomfortable with the idea of the Jewish state being in part run by some of its non-Jewish citizens. And this is, look, I mean, it's the inevitable result when you have an ethnocracy. That's the kind of attitude you're going to get. And the notion that you can somehow have equal rights under those circumstances is just, you know, it just doesn't work out that way in any ethnocracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, just put the shoe on the other foot for a second here. And we have a history like this in the United States. But just think of how absolutely intolerable it would be for the Democratic or Republican Party coalitions to say, oh, yeah, but no Jews. No sure. Blacks.
Of course, there was a time when they did say that. And, you know, I think that's where you want to place, I think, a little bit of hope for the future, because there was a time that Democrats, you know, would say, you know, we will not have Blacks in our Congress, even though they were unable to necessarily stop it. But they certainly isolated anyone who was, you know, African-American from any sort of coalition. And even today, you still have, you know, I would say racism in our government without, you know, in very practical ways. So there's a way that we can hope that this changes in the future, as we can look at our own past and see that in some ways it has changed, not to the point of equality, but certainly better than what you have, where people can explicitly say we will not sit in a government with Arabs. So one has to hope. And I think you can also look even at this election and say the joint list managed to get 15 seats, and they did better than expected because they, A, were able to really rally a lot of the Palestinian citizens of Israel to vote for them, but also because there was an unprecedented number of Jews in Israel who voted for them. So there are people who recognize that any progressive future for Israel depends on Arab-Jewish cooperation and transcending the ethnocracy of Israel today.
Yeah. And just for the record, in the United States, they outlawed the all-white primary in the 1960s, about 10 years before I was born.
Yeah, but that's not that long ago.
Yeah, no, it's really not, except that if you check all the white hair in my beard, then you start to wonder. In the scheme of things, yeah, it was quite a long time ago. All the kids that were hippies then are all the old right-wingers now.
So. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so now... Okay, so Gantz had promised that there is no way that he is going to join in a coalition government with Netanyahu. As you said, that's why they had three elections. They could have made this deal back when. And I understand what you're saying, that if he had joined in the coalition with the Arab joint list, that, well, that probably would have fallen apart before too long.
Yeah.
But still, we would have been rid of Netanyahu, and maybe actually keeping him out would have been a good enough incentive for the disparate parties to stay together in the coalition, because at least they got rid of Netanyahu. Why was that so hard for him to decide that?
First, I mean, even if Gantz had committed himself to trying to form a government with the support of the joint list, it's not at all certain he would have been able to succeed. As I said, just with the idea floating about, two members of his own party bolted and said, "We will not, you know, we will not agree to support this kind of government." So that right away took away a good shot at the potential majority that they could have had. So it was definitely a bumpy road, and one that, if you had to bet, probably would not have succeeded. Now, you know, that being said, Gantz didn't really try all that hard. And I think there were a couple of reasons for that. I think one was that Gantz is really not a politician. I don't think that when he came into this, he signed up for, you know, three rounds of elections and a year and a half of constant campaigning. I mean, he's a reluctant campaigner at best. If you actually, you know, when you watch him speak publicly, it is not he's not comfortable doing it. It's not something he enjoys. It took him forever to come out with a platform even last year. So, you know, this is not a game that he enjoys playing anything like, you know, Netanyahu does. This is Netanyahu's life. So I think he was exhausted. And then I think, you know, when the coronavirus crisis hit, from his point of view, it gave him a way out. It gave him an excuse to say, look, for the good of the country, we can't go to more elections. And I've got to find some way to make an agreement with Netanyahu just so that we can get through this crisis. How much of that was an excuse and how much of that was sincere? I think, you know, it's a mix. I think, as I said, I think he was exhausted. I think he was also frustrated by the fact that it really didn't look like there was a very solid path forward to a new government. It was clear that Netanyahu was going to do anything that he could to hold on to power. And it just wasn't, it's not a game that Gantz is up to. I mean, one of the reasons that Netanyahu has survived election after election is that he just hasn't had a really strong opponent. Gantz was the strongest one, and he just couldn't go 15 rounds with this guy.
Yeah. Well, which makes sense. If there's a fanatic in Israel, it's Benjamin Netanyahu, fanatic for his own power anyway. But now, so what kind of compromises were made here? You know, Netanyahu had floated a couple of weeks ago, and I think was pretty clearly lying at the time, that, oh yeah, Gantz agreed to join in a coalition government with me, and I promise I'll turn over the prime ministership to him in about 2 years or something like that. And yeah. Gantz said, well, that's a lie. If that's true, how come you're announcing it in the papers instead of sending your guys to discuss it with my guys and this and that? But then I think from what I've read here, they've made no such deal. Netanyahu does not have to step down at any point in the near future at all.
No. The deal is Netanyahu will be the prime minister for 18 months, at which time he will switch roles with Gantz and become the deputy prime minister. That was an important aspect of the deal for Netanyahu because they've also made an agreement that the deputy prime minister can continue to serve even if he's under indictment. So members of the Knesset cannot serve if they are indicted. They have to leave the Knesset. But the actual way that works is that it's not that they have to leave, it's that the prime minister has to fire them. So this was a loophole that allowed Netanyahu, despite being indicted, to stay in because he's the prime minister. So he doesn't have to, you know, he would have to fire himself, which he doesn't do, and therefore he stays in. So they've now added that the deputy prime minister has the same shield, essentially. They've changed the law so that the deputy prime minister can also stay in government despite being indicted. That's part of this agreement. So Netanyahu, what Netanyahu gets is that if he sticks to this agreement, in 18 months, he would step down and become deputy prime minister, still serving despite being under indictment while he fights his legal battles, which he can, of course, prolong for years and years. Mm-hmm. That's what he fought for. Now, so according to the deal, yeah, he would have to step down. Nobody, literally, I have yet to find a single person who says, yeah, sure, I believe that Netanyahu is going to step down in 18 months. Right. Right, left or center, nobody believes it. Because people know better. And of course, Netanyahu now has 18 months to destroy this agreement. And in 18 months, you know, one has to be pretty sure that he's going to find a way to do just that. Mm-hmm. That's plenty of time for him. So somewhere in there, I expect he will bring down this government. He will call for new elections or do something else to just change the nature of the deal, so that he doesn't have to step down in 18 months. But, you know, right now, on paper, that is what he has to do.
Mm-hmm. And now, so have they already voted and they do have the right to form this government now? And I wonder about all the different parties that made up the blue and white coalition that Gantz had promised he'd never support Netanyahu. Are any of them dropping out now?
Well, Yeah, the government has not been officially voted in yet. They're still in the process of hammering out all the last details of the agreement. And those details are still coming out. So that is still to come, probably in within the next week. But almost immediately when Gantz said he was going to, you know, negotiate a unity government with Netanyahu, his blue and white coalition split. So the blue and white coalition had been him, basically four leaders, himself, another, two other former chiefs of staff, Gabi Ashkenazi and Moshe Ya'alon, and Yair Lapid of the Yesh Atid party. Ya'alon and Lapid split off immediately. They abandoned the coalition and said, we are not going to sit in this government. We promised we would oppose Netanyahu, and that's what we're going to do. You know, as many people have pointed out, for both Lapid and Ya'alon, it's personal. They really, really hate Netanyahu, and Netanyahu has stabbed them both in the back in the past when each one of them has been part. Ya'alon used to be Netanyahu's defense minister. Lapid used to be his party used to be in the coalition with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu stabbed them both in the back. They hate him. They want him out. So for them, it's personal, whereas for Gantz, it's a political issue. So I think that's part of where that split comes from. But what one of the things that that does is that with half of the former blue and white coalition in the opposition sitting with Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beitenu party, right now also sitting in the opposition is the left-wing Meretz party, obviously the joint list, and also the far right-wing Yamina party would all be in the opposition. So what does that add up to? It adds up to a completely incoherent opposition that, you know, would agree on absolutely nothing except that they hate Netanyahu. That will mean a divided opposition that Netanyahu will be facing, and he has the relatively centrist Gantz at his side. So the way it shattered blue and white also means it shattered any serious opposition to Netanyahu's dominance at least for right now.
Yeah, well, you got to hand it to him; he's good at math.
He's also very good at politics. I mean, this is the game he plays. He plays it very, very well. Gantz, frankly, never stood a chance.
Hey, man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott and save $500.
Well, now, so where the rubber meets the road here, the real question is what this means for the Palestinians. And on one hand, they have a continuation of this extremely capable prime minister, especially who has so much influence in the United States and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And yet is also really a lightning rod in a lot of ways, too, especially mm-hmm. in the United States, I guess, right among liberal Zionists. But then at the same time, this guy Gantz, if it had been him, is probably not as capable at politics on the international level or that kind of thing. And yet at mm-hmm. the same time, is not the kind of lightning rod that Netanyahu is. And so maybe he would have, relieved some pressure on the Israeli government and would have been allowed to carry out Netanyahu's same policy with less pressure against it. I don't know.
Well, Gantz, I mean, right now the primary concern for the Palestinians given that Trump has basically taken everything away from them. The thing that is most immediately worrisome is that Israel will annex large chunks of the West Bank and would probably at this point do so in accordance with Trump's deal of the century plan, which would put almost all of the significant areas of the West Bank under Israeli control and would leave Palestinian towns and cities as islands in an ocean of Israel, essentially, on the West Bank. That is something that this agreement really paves the way for. Gantz does not oppose the annexation. All he wants to do is slow it down so that it doesn't, create a massive backlash against Israel and, I think in his view, also undermine hopes for better cooperation with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. Gantz basically was on the same page as Trump, or at least the Trump administration, in doing that. That's why part of their agreement is that this emergency government that he and Netanyahu have now formed can't really do anything for the first 6 months with the one exception of annexation. They can annex large chunks of the West Bank. And Gantz's stance is that they need to do this in coordination with the United States and, as he put it, the international community and the Palestinians, which is nonsense because the international community will object to any annexation. And obviously the Palestinians are not going to work with Israel on how to annex the West Bank to Israel. Mm-hmm. So what it really means is that they will cooperate with the Trump administration to do it. And I think that suits Netanyahu fine. The reason he had a problem with that was because of his right flank. But with this agreement, Netanyahu had the freedom to freeze out the Yamina party that I mentioned before, which is the far right party representing not only settlers, but it's that sort of the settler sort of point of view on these issues. And with them outside the coalition, the pressure on Netanyahu is lessened and he can much more easily make the case of, hey, look, the Trump administration is going to let us do this. We just have to do it, a little bit more carefully than we otherwise might have. And I think that'll sell to a lot of his right wing supporters. And for Trump, his whole reelection strategy is the same as his election strategy was 4 years ago, which is feed the base. And the way you feed the base on this issue is by annexation. So Trump wants to now, Trump also has a relationship with Saudi Arabia. So this is a concern that he wants to make sure that that Israel can annex, according to the Trump plan, without basically upsetting Saudi Arabia. And there's now a timetable. Starting July 1st, the Israeli government can agree to annexation. Trump will want to do it somewhere between July 1st and Election Day. So we know that's going to happen. We know Israel will want to do that because Joe Biden opposes annexation. And should Trump lose, that whole plan is then off the table. So all of this is happening. You might have noticed in my description, all of this is happening completely outside of the Palestinians' control, outside of their influence at all. Basically, Trump laid down his plan and said, if the Palestinians want to go along with this and want to talk with us about it, that's fine. But that's what they're going to need to do. They're going to need to come to us and say, we want to discuss this and figure out how to implement your wonderful deal of the century. Palestinians are obviously not going to do that. And so Mike Pompeo just this week made it very clear that annexation is Israel's decision. That is what he said. Right. That now, so U.S. policy is now that Israel can annex whatever it wants in coordinate. And he said, we'll discuss it with them. And he's clearly sent the message, you do this in coordination with us, but Palestinians essentially have nothing to say about it. That's U.S. policy now.
Mm-hmm. And just to make it clear for people who aren't all the way caught up on this, by annexation, this doesn't mean all of the West Bank, but it means some huge percentage of the settlements that are already there, as well as the entire Jordan River Valley. And what do the Palestinians have left?
Essentially, what the Trump plan envisions is that Israel will annex pretty much all of the West Bank except for Palestinian towns and villages, and then they will, you know, there will be small strips of land that will be used for roads to connect those towns and villages, and Israel will also compensate with some areas near the Gaza Strip, and essentially what it does is creates is complete Israeli control over the West Bank without actually having to admit the Palestinians living there as citizens. So they have some sort of technical autonomy within their own towns, but no, you know, but the region as a whole is completely controlled by Israel. So, you know,
it's really the inverse of what I just said. Rather than annexing the settlements and the roads between them, it's annexing everything and just leaving the Palestinian towns as though they are the settlements with the roads between them.
Exactly. And actually, that's a good way of putting it, because that's the way many, you know, that's the reality that many people now perceive. They perceive the Palestinians as settling in Israel. So Israel has managed through this project over these decades to completely reverse reality and give the impression that somehow Palestinians are interloping on Israeli land, which is, of course, the reverse of the truth. And the process by which they're doing this is at the same time a political one, but also a practical one. So in reality, Israel already controls all of that, those areas. It's simply a question of the acknowledgement of that and taking the idea of any pressure to make changes off the table. Mm-hmm. And that's what the U.S. is pushing for. And, you know, Europe is doing very, very little other than clucking its tongue. The United Nations is pretty much powerless with given the U.S. veto at the Security Council. And the Palestinians right now are looking for help from wherever they can get it. And frankly, in the United States, we're a little busy with the coronavirus. So it's very unlikely that we're going to see any serious pressure to stop this momentum anytime soon.
Well, and when you mention that Biden is for the two-state solution, I mean, so is the Center for American Progress. Doesn't mean anything, mm-hmm. right?
It means that he's opposed to this step. He's opposed to formally annexing the West Bank. And that isn't nothing. It is important. If Israel does annex all of its settlements and Area C and the Jordan Valley, all of these areas. If Israel does do that, yeah, there will be all sorts of protests and yelling and screaming. But 10 years from now, that's going to be the new normal. It will be something that everyone simply accepts as the way it is, just as we now accept that Israel has settlements that, you know, the major settlement blocks will be part of Israel. Everyone just accepts that, even mm-hmm. though there's no real basis for that, and certainly Palestinians haven't agreed to that. Right. So it is important that this be averted. It's not impossible that it can be if it can be delayed until Biden gets in, because Biden will object to it. It's not, you know, Biden, I don't think anyone confuses Biden with the great friend of the Palestinians. But at the same time, the difference between him and Trump is still enormous, and taking this step would make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that. It seems like the kind of step that he wouldn't have taken if he'd been sworn in 3.5 years ago. And yet his support for a Palestinian state is always just not in the real sense, but just in the BS sense that, yeah, we're going to kick this can down the road and let more and more facts be created on the ground. You can go ahead and annex it at the end of my 8 years instead of the beginning.
I think there's a bit of that. I do think that he is pretty much in line with groups like the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and groups like that, you know, who certainly see this as pushing a quote-unquote two-state solution that really favors Israel, that, you know, includes a demilitarized Palestinian state that's completely dependent on Israel. So, you know, that's true. At the same time, I think more progressive forces have a way of at least trying to steer that conversation. If that's where it is, if we move to annexation, there's almost nothing that groups like J Street, groups like the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, the groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, the American Friends Services Committee, these groups that really try and defend actual Palestinian rights and try to come up with a truly just solution to this that works for everyone. If annexation moves forward, the road to any kind of progress in that vein, I think, is very, very, it might be closed off completely and certainly becomes very, very narrow.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what about the kind of strange counterfactual here that actually Netanyahu is committing suicide for the Jewish state? And because he's so good at politics, he's so stupid about the reality of the situation. He's trying to create not just a de facto, but a de jure apartheid state there in a way that maybe the planet Earth has let them get away with so far while pretending that someday there's going to be a Palestinian state, where now they're virtually announcing that half the population of Israel will never be represented. They'll never have any civil rights to participate in the government, and they'll never have any, you know, actual civil liberties protections the way Israeli citizens do in their courts or from the Shin Bet or the IDF. And essentially just half the population, or a substantial part of the population of Israel, is not free and will not be free because they're not Jewish, simple as that, and from the river to the sea, and that is untenable, even though, you know, the kind of half solution of, oh, yeah, we're going to give you a Palestinian state someday, which will never come. They were getting away with that, and maybe they won't be able to get away with this. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's possible. It remains to be seen. And certainly that's the argument that this precludes the idea, and it clearly precludes any notion of a Jewish and democratic state. Some would argue that those two things can't go together anyway, but whether they can or not, certainly the course that Israel's on now precludes any real meaning of democracy in any serious sense. Now, is it tenable? Who knows? Israel has done things. I mean, one of the things about this particular moment is we've seen that things are tenable that we constantly said were not. The move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem was supposed to set off a massive conflagration across the Middle East. It didn't. It was something I warned people about saying at the time. I said, you keep saying this is what's going to happen. If it doesn't happen, and it's very likely that it won't, what people are going to realize is that a lot of these arguments are just not very valid, and they can go ahead without fear of very many consequences. So far, no one has stopped Israel from these things. Israel, this sort of argument that you just made and the fear of it is what has stopped Israel itself. But the more that Netanyahu pushes the envelope, the more people realize that, life goes on no matter what Israel does, no matter how much they deny Palestinians their rights, no matter how deeply entrenched they make the occupation. So until something actually turns them back, I'm not certainly going to bet on the idea that a blatant apartheid in this way, taking the mask off, is something that the world isn't prepared to tolerate. So far, nothing has been too far.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you this, and it's all hypothetical, future oriented stuff, but my Palestinian friends that I interview on the show, they hate this idea. Ali Abu Nima and Ramzi Baroud, they're both one state guys, but they want a brand new state. And my idea is that all the Palestinians, and there's so much, nonviolent protests, civil disobedience type protests that goes on. Mm-hmm. Not that they get any media coverage most of the time anyway, but there's so much kind of peaceful protesting on the part of the Palestinians anyway, that my idea is they ought to all demand Israeli citizenship. They ought to go ahead and admit that Israel annexed the West Bank and the Gaza Strip back in 1967. And they've just been pretending that they haven't this whole time. That's exactly what they did. And one state for one people, call it Israel. And if you want to rename it Israelistine later or whatever after the big fight in the Knesset, fine. But just they should demand citizenship like the 1/5 of the population of Israel, or less now, I guess, of the Muslims and Christian Arab citizens of Israel, or Palestinian citizens of Israel, as they're called, and join with them. Then, it'll be the end of the pretense of some sort of independent state or some sort of limited autonomy under the PA or any of this kind of thing. And then that way, all of the kind of
you know, the wool that's been pulled over everybody's eyes will be completely cleared out of the way, and it'll be a much simpler argument to take on, as the Israelis have to figure out a way to deny citizenship to millions of people who live under their control in a way that right now the argument is just too diffused, I guess, between one state that looks like this or two states that look like that and things like that. But so what do you think would be the reaction inside Israel? Like, wouldn't that put their back up against the wall where they really have no choice now? If they're going to annex the land, they've got to annex the people, too.
I think there are certainly people who are very afraid of that. I mean, that's at this point, look, that's where most of the support for the two-state solution comes from, is that very argument. I also, I'm aware of a number of Palestinian friends of mine and leading activists who think that's exactly where things are going, and that that's where things should go, that this is not an issue of one state or two states or any of that. It's an issue of rights, and that Palestinians demanding their rights is the way to go, and that Israel has really left Palestinians no option. I tend to agree with that. I think that that's exactly the argument that should be made, that this is a question of rights, that and that you can bring Palestinians into existing structures in Israel. I mean, I do think that creates a completely different country. You know, as I characterized Israel before as an ethnocracy, it wouldn't be that anymore. It would actually be a democracy, and that would be a country that looks completely different from what Israel is now, although it would still have a lot of its Jewish sort of spirit, Hebrew language, and you know, obviously it would have the greatest, you know, the highest percentage of Jewish population in the world. But that is exactly the direction that it's going in, and it would remove, I think, you know, I've said for, you know, decades now that the entire argument about one state or two state is irrelevant. We're nowhere near there, and the question of structures is something that we can decide once we decide that everybody's rights are first going to be acknowledged, respected, and given legal protection. We don't have that. Until we have that, there's no resolving this conflict, and I believe that 20 years ago. I believe it now. I agree with that concept. I think a lot of Palestinians agree with that concept. I think more and more of the Israeli left is recognizing that that's the only possible future, that doesn't include, literally denying millions of people their rights. So, I think that, and I do think it's more than just a theoretical question. I think it is a question of how do we discuss the issues now. I know that for me personally, as somebody who is neither Israeli nor Palestinian, but as an American Jew, who's somebody who's very, you know, obviously concerned and involved with this issue, that's the way I try to frame it. It's a question of rights. And I don't really care how the rights are recognized, as long as everyone's rights are fully recognized equally. That should be the framework. It's a framework that I think Americans can understand an awful lot better than the question of what does the two-state solution mean, and how does that square with historical injustices, and et cetera. It just gets so complicated. Whereas equal rights is a very simple concept, and one that Americans believe in very strongly.
Yep. All right, you guys. Well, that is Mitchell Plitnik, and he is the president of Rethinking Foreign Policy. That's at rethinkingforeignpolicy.org. And here he's got this great piece at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, otherwise known as the Low Blog. Israel's unity government protects Netanyahu from prosecution, paves the way for annexation. Thanks very much, Mitchell. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Anytime.
All right, y'all, and that's it for Anti-War Radio for this morning. I'm your host, Scott Horton, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and editorial director of antiwar.com. You can find my full interview archive, again, more than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org. And I'm here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. See you next week.